This is Maine Currents, a WERU pop-up show covering independent local news, views, and culture. I'm Amy Brown. If you're new to the area or just to WERU, you may not be aware of the strong connections between Maine and El Salvador that have developed over the years. Bangor has a sister city there called Coraske. You may have seen the work of some of their crafters featured at fundraisers like PICA's annual auction, or some of the artwork in the WERU studios that they made. MOFCA has a sistering relationship with a farming organization in El Salvador, and WERU has a sister radio station, Radio Sampul. The connections started in the 80s as some of the Salvadoran people displaced by the war there returned home from refugee camps. Allies from the U.S. accompanied them, hoping their presence would make the process safer. In more recent years, there have been regular delegations to El Salvador. In 2007, I participated in a delegation organized by MOFCA that was exploring the possibility of working with coffee growers there. And about 10 years ago, I traveled through the country learning about the impacts of mining on the very limited supply of clean water in El Salvador and being an elections observer for a vote on an anti-mining bill. That delegation was organized by the Bangor-based group PICA and Sister Cities. Meredith DeFrancesco and I both reported back from those delegations, as well as others that Meredith joined, and some of the reports are still up on our archives at weru.org if you'd like to listen. Other WERU staff and volunteers have participated in delegations as well, including Willie Marquardt, who's been there many times, and Carolyn Coe. There have also been delegations coming here from El Salvador. Folks from El Salvador have traveled here on speaking delegations, and Radio Sampul's crew joined the WERU folks at a radio conference in Massachusetts several years ago. A delegation of folks from this area visited with our sisters in El Salvador again earlier this year. All of them have traveled to the country before. Some have been regularly traveling there for decades. So we sat down earlier this month to talk about their experiences and how things have changed under the new administration, one that admires Donald Trump, doesn't respect civil liberties, and has been accused of using anti-gang laws to lock up political adversaries.
I'm Karen Volkhausen. I live in Orland, Maine, and I've been a member of the Bangor Coraske Sister City Project since 1992. And I'm also a member of the MOFCA El Salvador Sistering Project since 2001.
I'm Paul Volkhausen, and I'm a farmer in Orland, Maine as well. And my connections, I've been involved with Sister Cities almost as long as Karen. But I never was able to travel until late 90s, and then made a connection with the farmers in El Salvador and have maintained that connection since then. And I'm also part of the Bangor Coraske Sister City and the MOFCA Sister City organizations.
I'm Katie Greenman, and I have been involved peripherally in the 90s, kind of aware of what PICA was up to. But I didn't get seriously involved until 2003 when I participated in a delegation to El Salvador and Coraske. And I've been active going on a number of delegations since then.
I'm Willie Marquardt. I live in Bucksport, Maine. I work at WERU with Amy, and I'm a member of the MOFCA Sister Cities group. And also WERU has a sister radio station, Radio Sampul. In Guajira, in El Salvador. And I've been interested in El Salvador for about 50 years, but I never really got involved until I met Karen and Paul and joined the MOFCA group. And I've been going down there since. And there was a stint there where for five years, I was the U.S. coordinator of the network. I'm now retired from that.
Of the sistering network?
Yep.
Right. And I should mention that I've been fortunate to travel to El Salvador twice, and Katie hasn't been on either of the delegations that I went on, but I've traveled with the rest of you all in 2007 and 2014. 2007 was with the MOFCA sistering organization on a coffee-related delegation. 2014 was on a delegation looking at the impacts of mining in the country. And met with a lot of people who were resisting that. And I have a sense that and I've interviewed people who were involved early on during the war in El Salvador in the past. That may still be available on our archives, but I don't remember the chronology. I have a sense that this all started with accompaniment during the war. Can you talk about that and the origins of the sistering relationships? Was the Bangor sister city relationship with Carrasque and Chalatenango the first one, or how did, everybody jump in and let me know how that all evolved.
Well, Sister City, the U.S. El Salvador Sister City was born in 1986 during the middle of the Civil War. And it really was about accompaniment because people were coming back from external or internal refugee places. And sometimes it was families in the city, or they were in Nicaragua, or in the Mesa Grande in Honduras, and they needed support. They needed solidarity. And so this concept was born of connecting towns in the United States with communities, returning communities in El Salvador. And that was the beginning of it. I think the first, there's an issue about it, but I think I found in the archives when I was volunteering there one year that Cambridge was the first one, but Madison, Wisconsin says they were the first one. So I'm not sure which was first.
So they have sister cities in other places in El Salvador.
Yes, yes. A lot in Chalatenango, where Carrasque is, our sister city, but in other departments as well.
Katie, why was the accompaniment necessary? And what does accompaniment actually mean for anyone who hasn't heard about those days? Or anybody else who, Katie, and I'm looking at Karen, sorry about that. Karen, feel free to jump in. Karen or Paul, I think you two have been involved the longest. Am I correct in that?
Yeah. Karen, definitely.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Well, accompaniment, solidarity, it's standing with people. It's standing with people. They take the lead in this. We're not there saying, okay, I think you should do this, and I think you should do that. It's nothing like that. We stand by them. We stand with them. And because of the situation in the mid-80s, the war was still on. It was pretty grim and awful. We did give the different sister cities did give economic support for modest projects, like maybe starting a bakery in the community they were starting to rebuild, or a store, very, very modest projects. But it also gave them a window into the world, or the world a window into them, I think is a better way to put it, that these people were here suffering in the middle of a war. And why? I mean, they were fighting for justice, human rights, land, the right not to be poor again, I mean, forever. And so it's a really powerful relationship when you have a solidarity relationship, and it's different. I don't think charity is bad or wrong. I think it's really helpful to people, but this is it's more of a partnership.
It's deeper. It goes much deeper.
Yeah. Much different.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that strikes me that the reason this was so necessary is that our government, the U.S. government, was supporting the Salvadoran military. And they were the ones, you know, training soldiers. They were helping, assisting with all kinds of military aid. And these were the soldiers that then committed massacres that are still remembered every year by communities in El Salvador.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the details of the massacres mm-hmm. there, if anybody just wants to Google that, brace yourself. It's very, very... Mm-hmm. There's some really horrible information out there. The other piece of that, too, though, is that as part of coming to an agreement and settling the war, basically it was like, okay, we're not going to prosecute anybody for anything. The people who may have committed war crimes, nobody was kind of held to account and tried for anything that happened during the war. Is that right?
On both sides, I think.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think there were some trials. I mean, some egregious acts, like the murder of the Jesuits in San Salvador in 1989. I think that was one that might have gone to trial. Mm-hmm. Don't know.
Because they were not combatants within the war, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were not combatants. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We stood on the side of the poor.
But
in general, you're right. There was an amnesty. Not amnesty, but a reconciliation in general.
And that comes into play today, too, with how the current president feels about the peace accords. He told he claims that they're a total farce. Mm-hmm. And that's why it may give him the right to sort of renege on that amnesty for people who committed war crimes from the FMLN side.
Which is the side that was fighting, more farmers and people living in the rural areas.
Mm-hmm. So, it's still at play today in the current government.
Yeah, there's some stirrings of those being brought up, and there's some people being persecuted now for things they did before the war really started too.
Mm. Yeah, using that as an excuse because they were also very active in anti-mining and protection of water campaigns.
Mm. Well, it's recently been brought to my attention that there are people alive today and adults who were not around in the 1980s. I don't know how that happened, but what was happening in Central America was really in the forefront of the news, especially in the late 80s, early 90s. And a lot more people were aware of the situation. There are a lot of people who may not, and God knows there's enough other things to worry about now that they may not be aware of the history of this, but archaeological excavations of some of the sites of the massacres, finding that not only was it as bad as people say, in some cases, it was even worse, finding bones of children and just horrible things. The people who committed those atrocities were never held to account, but the current president is now trying to revive the specter of the war by saying that people who are fighting to protect water from mining there committed murders during the war and trying to use that to keep them in jail. Is that correct? Do I have that narrative right?
They were arrested and put in prison because of alleged crimes that were committed during the Civil War. I believe they've been released.
No, yes and no.
But they've been released, but they're still, they're under parole or whatever.
They're still on trial. They're still going to be tried.
Still going to be tried, yeah. But I don't think it's come out that the president, I don't believe, has said that it's because of their anti-mining activity.
Right. I mean, that connection has been made by others. But when I was there in 2014, Willie, you were on that delegation. We went around and, or were you? No, you weren't.
I was not on that one.
We went around to some of the mining locations and saw what was happening there. And there was a lot of community organizing against anti-mining because there's not a ton of water in El Salvador, and what they have could be threatened by mining. And they showed us some places where there was already contaminated water because of old mining projects. And at that time, it seemed like the anti-mining activists were pretty out in the open. We went to a big rally in the center of San Salvador that was supporting, that was promoting anti-mining, and also went to one of the villages, I believe it was in Carrasque, that passed, we were election trained and then did election observation for a vote in that municipality to oppose mining. And that passed with a great majority. And there was a lot of celebration about that. And it seemed to be headed in a direction that seemed to be going quite well. What has happened in the past 10 years? You've recently, the four of you have recently returned from another delegation. So set the stage and then maybe tell us what you saw when you went down this time.
Well, those plebiscites they had, there were, I don't know, 5, 6, 10 of them around the country, most of them in Chalatenango. And the anti-mining things would win like 400-2. That's how many people would vote for banning mining. And by 2017, the national legislature actually outlawed mineral mining in the country. It's the only time that's ever happened in the world. And that law is still on the books, but things have changed now with the current president is into developing Bitcoin. So I think he's got designs on opening up mining again.
Yeah.
I think it's a really very scary and serious issue because, I mean, one thing we we learned a lot about, we knew about, but we learned a lot about, was a state of exception that the president declared. And it allowed, it was dealing with the gangs, which were a terrible problem, but it allowed him to sweep up young men and put them in prison without any due process of law. And that's a whole other issue, and we can talk about that. But that state of exception is still on, and it's been used in other situations. Like there's, they want to build an airport in the east of the country, and the land they want, they're going to seize it by eminent domain, and people live on it. And people who have been saying no and protesting against that have been arrested under the state of exception. So they're in jail without any due process of law. It's very dangerous. So what it means to me is that they can just sweep up protesters now. If this comes to light and really becomes the issue and they're going to have mining, they're going to crush the opposition. So that is extremely, extremely concerning.
They are using anti-gang laws against activists who are against mining.
Those people that we were talking about, that those people from the thing we were talking about a few minutes ago about those people, they got swept up by that state of exception, right? You know, and that was 2 years ago. That's been going for 2 years. The gang problem was so bad. I mean, it was the murder capital of the world, and people were getting extorted and raped, and it was horrendous. It was not safe. And they've swept up about 75,000 people, men. And probably from the people we heard when we were down there, is probably 80% of those people are innocent. So, I mean, they're using it for anything. So it makes it kind of fearful. And even since we were in Chilate, in Guajira, they sent the military in a few weeks later because there was a murder somewhere down there. They used the excuse to send several thousand troops in there. It's kind of intimidating.
Mm-hmm. Very intimidating.
In 2014, the FMLN, were they already in power by then? Yeah. I think that they were. Yeah. Yeah. The first time they weren't. So what happened since then? How did this particular president, is it Bukele? Is that how you say his name?
Nayib Bukele. Yeah.
He likes mainstream media, keeps calling them strong men. And I keep saying, don't say that to myself, because that's what they want to be thought of as. Use the word dictator when you mean dictator. Tell us about this new president and what happened politically to go from the FMLN being finally in power to where they are now.
Nayib Bukele was the mayor of San Salvador, as far as, correct me if I'm wrong on that, but he was a member of the FMLN party. And then he left under a number, you know, disagreements, whatever. But he was extremely popular, and people liked him. You know, he formed the Nuevas Ideas Party, the New Ideas Party. He's young, he's dynamic, he's a good speaker. He can rally a crowd. These all things sound very familiar, and. You know, he won very resoundingly. He got into office, and then he started to employ the state of exception to take care of the gang problem, many human rights violations that we've already mentioned. He is into full control. Mm-hmm. He started, you know, maneuvering, you know, changing things in the judicial branch. Changing things in the legislative assembly. He currently has full power of all branches of government. Mm-hmm. And he basically can do whatever he wants. And the most recent thing is that he's been able to change the constitution to allow for any change in article. They used to have to wait, introduce something to a change in the articles in one legislature, and then it would have to be ratified in the new legislature. But now it can happen prior to that. And this change took place just very recently.
Yeah, and constitutionally, he was not supposed to be able to run consecutive terms. And he just said he was going to do it. And they did it. And his judicial said, yeah, it's okay. And he won with like 95% of the vote. He has like an 80 or 90% approval rating. I mean, people do like him because it's sad to say, sad and yet not. it's really safe down there now. It's not like it was because the gangs are gone.
There are people
safer. Maybe there. Americans going down doesn't sound like it's very safe for anybody who's trying to protect their water.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
You're listening to Maine Currents on WERU-FM. I'm Amy Brown, and my guests today are Katie Greenman, Willie Marquardt, and Paul and Karen Volkhausen. They're talking about their delegation earlier this year to El Salvador and how things have changed over the years that they've been visiting there.
Yeah, people who live in San Salvador, I spoke to a number of them in the delegation, and they are very happy with how things have changed. This is very cool in the social movements talk about what they're facing. Mm-hmm. But people, the general public, unless you've had a family member arrested unjustly, you are seeing, a very safe place to live and be.
The trains are running on time.
Mm. Something like that. Right. He's also called himself the coolest dictator in the world.
And he controls all the social media, too.
All of it.
Calculated. Very calculated thing to figure out how to calm the gangs down. And there was, I think it was more than rumor. I think there might have been some evidence that he paid off the gangs around the time he ran and things calmed down a little bit. And then it got worse again. And so there was a state of exception. And for the people who, I can understand that if you're afraid of your children being swept up in a gang, or your daughter swept up as, female gang member, which isn't very pleasant. I can understand that, but do they understand what they're giving up? Because I think they're giving up their democracy. And it was kind of a fragile, it always remained a fragile democracy. And I think the FMLN blew their chances in 10 years. They had two different administrations, especially the last one. It was, I think there was corruption in it. They could have brought in the UN, but that was the first one, I think. But they didn't want to do that because it would sort of bring the problem up, and they didn't want that, into the forefront. Well, it was in the forefront with the gangs. So I think they blew it. And now they're barely hanging on. I don't know if they will. I don't think they'll survive as a party, because you have to have, like us, so you have to have a certain amount, a certain percentage to maintain, in an election to maintain. And I don't think there are any FMLN in the
assembly. There aren't any.
There are maybe two or three municipalities somewhere.
Zero.
But in the district.
Karen saying in the municipalities.
Yeah.
I think so. A few.
There's a couple.
Like the and one those municipalities that voted for him. It was funny that all of a sudden there was some, there was soldiers in their community. So they're getting harassed. So, yes. So that is, yes. I don't know what else to say about that. It's just, it's awful. These people have fought so hard for what they have. And they have come a long way. And boom, just like that.
Right. Another thing that has happened is that there's a consolidation of departments or of municipalities. So there are fewer representatives in the legislature now. So these smaller communities in the rural areas have less representation and less access to funding from the municipal government. So that's the other worry. For Carrasque, especially, that we know well.
Mm-hmm.
This is all happening. I just, the part of me that used to be a therapist is always thinking about, and was constantly thinking when I was down there, about all the trauma that's contained in this small place. And we heard more about that when we had some visitors come from El Salvador. And like anybody who's experienced a lot of trauma, the anxiety of just being in a completely new place was just a lot for them to deal with. You have a country that's roughly the size of Massachusetts, that's filled with both sides in a war that was, we're talking people being dropped out of helicopters, killed that way, massacres of children, rapes and murders of nuns. but those folks are all living together. And now they're in a situation where they are being offered safety and all they have to give up is the right to protest or something. But this goes back to the origins of the war. There's a church there that we went to visit that had a, they still have like a bomb right next to the church, a U.S. bomb. And the priest would talk about how before the war, there were X number of families, 9, 19 or something, that controlled the entire country. And the priests that would be allowed to come to these villages up in the mountains and stuff were only priests who would preach that the Bible said that you had to be grateful with what you had, that if you didn't have shoes, you were going to get into heaven easier, that you needed to obey those families because they were closer to God and all of these things. And then there were some more liberation theologists who came in and taught people to read so they could read the Bible themselves. And they said, oh, there's some other stuff in here that you never mentioned. And so the community started organizing and trying to fight for their basic rights. And that isn't that long ago. I mean, the context of all of this really is not over a long period of time. So how is that impacting the people who are in the rural communities who participated on the FMLN side of the war, including our sister station, Radio Sampul, who have a famous story about battling off the troops that came to shut down the radio station by throwing hives of bees at them, which is quite a legend to have about your radio station. How is that impacting relationships between families and communities?
Thinking about Karaske in particular, I mean, they are a spirited community and they go on with their work. And but there's also, I think, a sense of being disheartened in some of the people. I mean, I won't mention names, but one person in particular who is just an incredible person, visionary, had a great vision of the future, didn't want people to come to the United States, wanted his family intact, wanted the families intact. I just saw a great deal of discouragement in him. He has two kids now and a grandkid or two in the States, and two incredible kids, and three really, but two incredible adult kids who are absolute shining stars in the community. But I've just never seen him like that. And there was a feeling of the community being hollowed out. There weren't as many people around. I think a lot of the youth have fled to the United States to avoid the state of exception and have been afraid for their lives. So that was one impression I got. I'd like to hear from Willie and Katie too, and Paul.
And Paul.
I saw very few men under the age of 50. Even in Karaske, there were a lot of women and young girls, mm-hmm. and there were young men like in high school, but mm-hmm. over that, they just weren't right. there anymore. Most of them have come up here. Yeah. There's no opportunity.
One of the things that we do is contribute some money to a scholarship fund for students to attend university programs. And we met with about 7 or 8 of them. I think most of them were female, but there was at least one mm-hmm. young man. They're engaged in all these different programs, and you would hope that when they finish those university programs that there would be jobs for them, you know, whether it's in computers or international relations or, you know, I can't remember all the various degrees they were studying, but a recent graduate who's helping mentoring with this program, he's graduated in sports education and he has not been able to get a job in his field. And so that's another reason. Lack of job opportunity is a reason for young people to leave.
Mm-hmm. And that's been going on for decades. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's been going on for decades. Karaske has a beautiful tradition of mentoring their young. So when you go to TIVA meeting, which is their town council, there are young people. I mean, they can have a young president who's late mm-hmm. teens or early 20s, and they are mentoring their young. And it's those people that are talented and committed, but they leave because of lack of opportunity, you know, over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Paul, did you want to add your impressions?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything that's been said, but I think, you know, there still is this incredible hope and enthusiasm in the people that are there. The two young people that Karen was talking about, of the family we stayed with, have just become leaders in their community. And just when you see their lives, it's just so full, and they are just really doing a great job of mm-hmm. you know, raising their families and supporting the community. So I think there are two things going on there, and the people that do find a niche and a way to stay are adding a lot to the community, but it is a shame that so many people are leaving.
How are those folks who are, I don't know if the organizations are even still together, but was CISPES and the one that's partnered with MOFCA?
CRIPDAYS.
Okay. How are the people involved with those organizations and the leaders of the directivas and in the organized community feeling about all of this? Do they have any sense about what needs to happen, how they could be supported, whether they're in direct danger themselves of being called gang members and locked up?
Well, for one thing, I'll talk about CCR, which is MOFCA's partner, and CORDAYS too. They do all this wonderful work, and they're just going on with it. They run a political school, for youth to look at the world and be able to assess and figure out things. They have some great projects. They have Women's Project, where they help them build home gardens or make home gardens. And then they have organizers who help the women learn how to use they call it green food, and then they make a cookbook. I mean, and this has been going on for a long time. So did they talk about discouragement? I don't remember, but they go on with their work. And I think the community directivas do too, you know, with their duties and what they have to do with their different groups in the community. I think they go on. Nobody's just stopping things.
No. There have been some raids on some organizations' offices to look at their finances, I believe, and where they're getting donations from. I know that happened in the first term, Bukele's term, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that we heard from Carlos Garcia, I believe he was at Equipo Maíz, another educational organization, and working at the grassroots level. You know, he said, if they come after them, they'll just have to go underground for a while, but they'll rise back up again.
He said, if we have to start over and build it from the ground up again, we'll do it. And, you know, there is that whole feeling of hope and you know, that there is a possible good future ahead of them, and they're going to keep working at it.
Right. Equipo Maíz, or Team Corn, which I learned it translates to. It's like one of my five words of Spanish that I always remember, or two of my five words of Spanish. There, if anybody's been to WERU and you've seen the calendar that we've kept up for years that has pictures of people from El Salvador on it, they're the ones who put together that calendar that has the people who were lost, killed, and disappeared during the war, as well as other educational materials. So it seems like they might be a target, even if they're being strong and they've been through a lot before. Did any of you have, or do you have any concerns about what might happen next to those organizations?
I do. Mm-hmm. I think they have concerns about it. I think they have concerns that they could just end. I mean, they talked about that. They could just end because the government ended them, however they would end them. Yeah. So we do have concerns. And how do you deal with that? I mean, you know, for years and decades, we've done so much work getting letters out from our congressmen and this and that that we could do to support what they were doing. And now, I mean, the president calls international solidarity terrorism. So I don't know if the people buy that, but it's hard to know how to speak out. Are you making people more unsafe if you do that? It's very hard to know.
Yeah.
It never was hard. We always spoke out.
Right.
But I think, you know, they're really into popular education. And basically popular education is you work with the people and, you know, at their level, and you just keep building that level up. And that's what they did during the war. And they were very successful for, you know, a long time. And then things got out of hand with the gangs coming back from LA. And then, like Karen said, you know, the FMLN did not do a very good job of governing in a lot of ways, and they've lost it, but they're going to keep working at that ground level and building back up again.
Training people in sustainability and agriculture and things like that, self-care and medical stuff.
And community organizing.
Yeah.
How to create their town, their local governments, and have different sectors of the community taken care of and looked after.
Mm-hmm.
And participating in the government. I think there's a great deal of resiliency.
Yeah.
And I think one of the messages that we came home with was that no matter what happens with the current government, that governments don't last forever. Eventually, people will realize that maybe they've lost important aspects of democracy, and there will be a rising up in some form.
You're listening to Maine Currents on WERU-FM. I'm Amy Brown. My guests today are Karen and Paul Volkhausen, Willie Marquardt, and Katie Greenman, all travelers many times to El Salvador. Their most recent trip was earlier this year, and they're reporting on some of the changes that they've seen over the years. Are you on standby to go down there and accompany folks again to try to keep them safe? Or do you think that would even be effective this time around? Or would you just be a target as much as them?
Well, that's why we keep going down there. That's how we keep our solidarity and accompaniment with them. Mm-hmm. I mean, the overall group that we work with down there is CRIPTES, which the CCR is a branch of in Chalatenango. And each different region has it. There's like five regions they work in. They're pretty worried about this, but, you know, they're like the heart of the social movement, and they'll keep coming back. I mean, they're. I mean, my whole impression of that whole trip was like, I was really happy to see the people, but it was so sad. You know, it's like depressing, and then it's so hard that there's a lot of hard questions there that haven't been answered yet, and things could be worse, and things could always get better. And it's the people that will make that happen.
You know, I kind of experienced that in El Salvador, too, trying not to be more sad than the people that it actually happened to. Looking at things like at the library where the priests were killed, and, you know, there's a very somber space there where you can look at actual documentation of what happened, and realizing I need to keep it together if they can keep it together, because my government was kind of behind all of this. What is the U.S. interaction with El Salvador now, including immigration, which is probably what most people hear about? But can you talk about their relationship with the Biden administration and their potential relationship with another Trump administration and remittances and all of that, that all go together?
Right now, as we all know, our government is so entrenched in two very serious and tragic wars that are going on. And I don't think El Salvador is very high on anybody's radar in the U.S. government at this time.
It was in the past because there was thought to be communism brewing in the areas around there.
Yeah,
that's correct.
What is it potentially going to be like if there's another Trump administration?
Well, I think that there is a great bond between the Trump and the dictator of El Salvador, the president of El Salvador. And so I think it'll be very friendly. What it turns into, I don't know. I think Trump will support whatever Bukele wants to do. I don't think they're that friendly with the Biden administration, but I agree, Katie. I don't think, you know, we're not paying much attention to them anymore.
I think that the thing that will be constant, and sort of would be, but it doesn't matter if it's Biden or Trump, is that our State Department is so Well, I mean, personally, I don't think we do any diplomacy anywhere. I mean, we're kind of active in things. But one of the things of development that they've embraced is the private-public partnerships, and that's what they've been pushing there. And that's one way that they can funnel money into the people that already have money, which is what's going on now. I
Can you
mean,
say a little bit more about that, Willie, what those are?
it's sort of shaking hands with the government and the corporations working together. So basically, it's corporate control. They're trying to turn El Salvador into another corporate state, just like we are. And it sends the it's the corporate oligarchs that really run everything. And so I think that with Bukele, he's in bed with them. I mean, they're helping him build Surf City, and probably his Bitcoin things and his
Is
airports
Surf
and
City
tourism.
a tourist thing?
Yes,
Promotion.
there's a really good there's really good surfing there, and he's really building up that community.
Really, really strong undertow there too.
Yes.
So there's a road now going through right in front of our sister radio station, a giant highway. I think that's part of what you're talking about with these private public partnerships, right? Is that the government supports putting in a giant highway and through the rural areas so that companies can truck things out of there to the US?
Yeah, well, that one was the Trans-Pacific, whatever it was. It was to get the goods, and when they were going to get the gold and everything else, was the way they would get through there or move their drugs or whatever else they're pushing. And it did. I mean, Guajira, the first time we went there, at least I went there, there was a solar dryer fruit thing there. That's
Same.
gone because the highway went through there, and it's
That was
not there
actually
anymore.
still there after the highway. I was there one time after the
Not there
highway was
now.
built, but now that's gone. And that's too bad because that was like a great little enterprise. It's a place where they were picking fruit and then drying it so to preserve it, and it was really yummy.
And it got
But I
very
think that
sophisticated.
it's not really small businesses that they're trying to build up, That's the kind of rural businesses, but it's that big corporate money, I think. I might be wrong, but I think that that's where the statism is going.
So there's not much that people can do for jobs down there. I think a lot of people were sort of being self-sustainable in the more rural communities, from what I could tell, and then getting some remittances or support sent in from the United States. Do you have any idea how much that has changed the level of remittances and the danger levels of trying to come to the US?
Well, I think the remittances are still a very, very important part of the economy, really important part of the economy, a huge part of the economy. So I think, that remains important. What was your
The immigration safety. Those who emigrate, most all who have, I mean, everyone that has emigrated from El Salvador has made it to the US. There were some that were deported and sent back across the border, but I think eventually they made it across.
They keep going back and forth.
And yeah.
So does that mean the US is granting them refugee status or?
You know what? We don't really know.
Yeah, it's hard to tell
I
what's
don't think
going
we
on.
can, I don't think we can say, but I do know that there is a young man and his wife and child. They are trying to go through a legal process of getting a special visa to come to the United States. And I don't know the current status of that. But so, there are people that are trying to do it in other ways and just making that very dangerous journey.
And then the other thing that's about economically in the rural areas is it used to be all agriculture. But since the free trade agreements that went into effect 20 years ago, that just ruined any kind of agriculture sector they had there. It was cheaper to import goods. So there's no market for farmers, there's no opportunity
No, but they do grow and sustain, their families
there.
with food that's grown there locally, but they do have to supplement with from food vendors that come in bringing vegetables from Guatemala or other places. So
So people talk about the gangs as one of the fears that they have, gangs coming up from El Salvador. Paul, you made reference early on to something that I don't think a lot of people are aware of, that the gangs were actually more started here in the US, and some of the people who came to the US as refugees or immigrants were involved in that. Can you say a little bit about that and what is the experience when somebody finally gets here? How likely are they to join a gang? What kinds of work are the people that you know of who've moved here doing? I know you've had folks working on your farm. What else? What can you tell us about them here in the U.S. and how they function?
It's different than the people that are immigrating now. That was something that in Los Angeles and probably in some of the other big cities, I'm not really sure, but I know in Los Angeles that's the way people held together, that there were Chinese gangs and there were Salvadoran gangs, and that was how you made your place. And when they got arrested, they got deported back to El Salvador, and there was really nothing for them there. And so they reformed the gangs in El Salvador, and that was kind of the beginning of the problem. And then it grew and grew and grew and got completely out of control.
Right. Some of those who have emigrated here end up working in construction, in restaurant work, trying to think of other jobs that I know people I've talked to. But they are working. They are contributing to the economy. They're earning money. They're sending remittances home. There is one man who actually is able. He's got papers. He's able to go back, and he helps the community celebrate special events from time to time during the year. So it's there's a lot of giving back to the community by those who have emigrated.
And the migrant farm worker population in the summertime, you're probably more tapped into that as farmers yourself, Karen and Paul. Do you have a sense that we have folks who help the farm industry here in Maine who come from El Salvador, who travel here to do that? Because I just wonder, I've heard it said that if everyone who was an immigrant legal, you know, first generation immigrant legal or otherwise, were to just go on strike for one day, the whole country's economy would almost shut down because they are doing so many jobs that other people either haven't or won't take.
I think 20 or 30 years ago, there were some Salvadorans around here that came up, but I'm not aware so much now. There's Mexicans that come in, but they come in on a special visa. And there are farms, I don't know how many farms, but farms in Maine that hire them.
The patients too.
And the broccoli and, you know, the bigger, a lot of the dairy farmers have what's called H-2A visa workers that come in. But that's a whole different program than what the most of the Salvadorans that are coming up illegally and working illegally.
Why do you think that is? Right. Why do you think that is?
Well, the H-2A program is very limited in the number of people that it allows in. And there are just a lot more people that want to come to this country than that. And the H-2A is also, it's agricultural related. There are several other programs, immigration programs, where they bring in temporary workers, but there's just, there are a lot more people that want to come in for various reasons than we allow in. And that's why we have the problems that we have right now.
And once people come up without papers and establish themselves somewhere, then people from their communities or their families, they come up to the same place. So LA is a lot closer than the Northeast. I think there's a lot of Salvadorans in Boston, but you know,
Maryland.
Yeah. Maryland,
Denver.
Right? Yeah. Los Angeles, Colorado, Texas, tons and tons. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Well, there's the Latino community in Millbridge, people who had come down for the blueberry harvest and stayed. And there are, I think there may be some Salvadorans there, also Hondurans, Mexico.
Mano and Mano would be a good organization to check in with. You know, they would know where people are coming from. I think many of the people that have come from Carrasque, the United States, they have come and joined other family members that have come previously. Mm-hmm. So there's always that draw.
I think if people really are interested in El Salvador and want to know more, they should consider going on a delegation, because it is safe to go on a delegation and it's not horribly expensive. And I think I've rarely met anyone on a delegation that didn't get a lot out of it. And I would say another thing that we support a lot of projects in El Salvador through our, you know, we have a certain amount of money we send down every year from both the committees, probably all three committees. And I think if you want to support that economically, give to PICA, sister city through PICA, give to WERU's sistering project, give to Bangor.
And that money that goes down, again, is not for charity purposes. It's to support the organizing efforts within the community and with these other social movement organizations that support the rural communities. So I think that's important. I can't tell you how much the experiences of going to El Salvador have meant to me over the years. So meeting the people and learning from them has been invaluable.
Mm-hmm.
Inspirational.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. I've been nine times and I have been the same since the first time I went.
WERU, I know for a while, was donating a percentage or a dollar or something from new members to help support Radio Sampul. What's the best way if somebody wants to make a donation to support Radio Sampul, Willie, since you're the money person at the station? What's the best way for them to do that?
They could send in a check and you know, they can always designate where they want it to go. And they could put Radio Sampul and I would direct it into the money that we send down there. Right now we're sending about what we get for new members. It's actually a little bit more than new members we get these days. We send basically one check a year, but there's more money. That'd be great. It's been a while since anybody's donated to us for that.
Anybody have any last thoughts or things you did not get a chance to say that you want to add?
I think one thing that people should be aware of is just how quickly that transformation happened from a democracy to an autocracy. And the way that it happened is very similar to a lot of things that are going on in this country today. And I think that we should be well aware that can happen very quickly, even to us, if we're not paying attention.
That was Willie Marquardt, Karen and Paul Volkhausen, and Katie Greenman, local residents who've been involved in the sistering relationships between Bangor and Carrasque in El Salvador, between MAFCA and a sistering farming organization, and between WERU and our sister station Radio Sampul. Their latest delegation to El Salvador was in February of this year. While they were there, they visited WERU's sister station Radio Sampul in Wahila, a once quiet rural town that's now intersected by a highway. The radio station is named for the nearby Rio Sampul, a river that forms a border between El Salvador and Honduras. It was the site in 1980 of a horrific massacre in which villagers were pushed to the river by the right-wing Salvadoran military on one side and prevented from crossing by Honduran military on the other side. Then the military opened fire on the civilians. An estimated 650 people were slaughtered that day in a war that the U.S. funded and supported, and no one has ever been held accountable. Wrapping things up today, here's a greeting from our sister station, recorded in February when the delegation was there. It was taped as Willie went in to offer them a greeting from the WERU community, and they responded with greetings to send back to the Radio Weru, as they call us, community. Katie Greenman recorded this and translated, and John Greenman produced the audio.
En este es su programa La Cafecita Ranchera. Pues déjenme comentarles que este día tenemos acá una delegación de Ciudades Hermanas.
You are listening to Tardecita Ranchera. A sister city delegation from the United States is here and wants to greet you. With us here is Willie, who has come seven times to accompany Radio Sampul. Accompanying him in this greeting is Rubia Guardado from Crites.
Bienvenido.
Saludos de Radio Weru en los Estados Unidos. El llamamiento de Radio Sampul. ¡Que viva Radio Sampul!
¡Que viva! ¡Que viva! Como organización social, ¿verdad? Como Crites y CCR,
as a social organization like Crites and CCR, We are very happy to have here the Sister City delegation of U.S. El Salvador Sister Cities, who are visiting the communities of Carrasque and Arcatao, and how good it is that it's at the time we find ourselves at the national level, that they've come to visit and see the reality of what is happening in our country, and that they take this important message to the United States. This is the great strength and the great unity with which sistering has always supported the communities and organizations. We thank you for this visit and the accompaniment you've always given, and we hope that you come again soon, right? And that you always accompany us every year. You will learn how things are going in the organized communities and what they are working on. We have already met and talked about the national context. Many thanks for this visit, and we feel proud that you are here at Radio Sumpul.
Willie, ¿quieres hablar algo más?
Do you want to say anything more?
Que viva!
Que viva la radio!
Que viva!
Que viva las comunidades de CCR!
Que viva! Que viva.
Bueno, gracias. Gracias, William, por venir a visitar la radio Sumpul y querer dar ese saludo, ¿verdad? Desde la radio Güero.
You can find Radio Sumpul on Facebook. Sumpul is spelled S-U-M-P-U-L. Their Facebook, actually I think they have two Facebook pages now, but they tend to be quite active on Facebook, sometimes streaming from their studios if you want to hear what they're playing down there at any given time. For Maine Currents, I'm Amy Brown. You're listening to Community Radio WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill, and streaming online at weru.org. And don't forget the smartphone app.